Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from April 10th, 1999.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, across all these many time zones, stretching from the Hawaiian and Tahitian Islands out west, eastward to the Caribbean, the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to Santa Country at the Pole, and worldwide on the Internet. Thank you, Broadcast.com, and of course, Intel, that together provide this amazing new thing called streaming video. Or, if you will, screaming video. Our affectionate name for it, Almost TV. Here's the deal. You go to my website, www.artbell.com. You download something called the G2 Player. It's free, F-R-E-E, free, 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 free. And then you come back to my website and click on the streaming video, and there I'll be, a talking head, doing my talk show. You'll be able to actually see me in the studio with about three different camera shots, and of course hear the show as well. Now, the other thing Broadcast.com is doing is archiving all the shows, so that you can actually go during the day, if the boss isn't looking, and you can watch and listen to a show during the day as well. Pretty cutesy, huh? All right, welcoming a new affiliate tonight. It would be KRWB Radio. It's KRWB AM. They're 1410 on the dial, and they're in Roseau, Minnesota. It's actually spelled R-O-S-E-A-U, but it's Roseau, Minnesota. And I hope I'm close to having that correct. Thank you, Brian Douglas, who's the PD there. Glad to have you with us. Well, I hear that my friend Curtis Sliwa in New York City is at it again. And now he calls me Rama. He's been calling me Rama, which is all right. Now, Curtis is the only one allowed to call me Rama. I am to Curtis Rama, and of course he does my bidding, as I have told you previously. So he is the only one, since his visit out here that he tells everybody in New York about. He's been indeed a devotee doing all of my bidding, and so yes, only to you, Curtis, may I be addressed as Rama. Okay. What's going on in the war? Yugoslav authorities have sealed off. Now, this is a reversal because, of course, they were virtually driving ethnic Albanians out of Kosovo. And now they have reversed course in midstream. And they are driving everybody back into Kosovo who was leaving. They've actually closed the main border crossings, preventing Albanians from leaving as they were. As a matter of fact, it was getting near the half-million mark, but now they've reversed course. They have also called for a unilateral ceasefire. In other words, they are holding their soldiers in the barracks. But NATO says, no ceasefire. They will, I guess, have a ceasefire long enough to send in the Cypriots, who are going to try and free three U.S. servicemen, but after that the bombing will resume and maybe even intensify. Until what? I'm not exactly sure. By the way, next hour, we're going to talk to Broughton Coburn. We are going to do that in Nepal. He's in Kathmandu, Nepal, and I'm going to do it. I have been fascinated with Mount Everest. It's the highest point in the world, you know. There is nothing, I would never, in my wildest dreams, would I ever consider climbing a mountain. I am not your basic mountain climber. In fact, I'm not even good on phone poles. as years of back problem would indicate. So I would, but I am fascinated by mountain climbing and by people who would be crazy enough, driven enough. I don't know what the right word is. They're compelled. It is insufficient to say, you say to somebody, why do you want to climb the mountain? Well, because it's there, right? It's the old saying. There's got to be more to it. And there certainly is more to the mountain. So I am going to again stretch my company's phone card to the limit and do an interview on the other side of the world. By the way, did you know that Nepal is about the only place where, when it's on the hour here, I think if it's, we'll have to ask, but I believe if it's 10 o'clock here in Nepal, it would be 11:30. It's the only time zone that actually is not on the hour. I guess in the world somewhere they had to have one, and it's in Nepal. Pretty weird, huh? Somebody told me that, and I didn't believe it. I said they were full of you-know-what. And then they cranked out something with all the time zones on the world, you know, on a world map, and sure enough, there is one time zone that has, I forget, it's either half an hour or 45 minutes. It's really weird. Well, watching and listening to Russia these days, the voice of Russia World Service, for example, on 15520, the 19-meter band, beginning at about 0100 Zulu, the Russians are beginning to take a very hard line on what's going on. According to the voice of Russia, Serb military and police forces were confined to barracks as part of the unilateral ceasefire. Other things included the request that the expatriate Kosovar civilians return to their homes and an offer of assistance to Albania in the repatriation process. According to VOR, when the unilateral ceasefire was announced, a 16-plane element took off from Aviano Air Base in Italy on a bombing mission. The ceasefire announcement was greeted reportedly with an our way or no way response. Probably smart, because it's probably a trap. Bearing in mind there is a certain amount of blatant propaganda, Russia is undoubtedly concerned that NATO will not stick to attacking one or another member of the CIS. And they could be right. Serbia is arguably one of the most historically persecuted communities on the planet, but is without doubt the most unforgiving. So, a moral adversary has been converted overnight virtually into a blood enemy. How smart was that? So there you have it. And, oh, by the way, Karen Anderson, who unfortunately got caught in the technical troubles of last night, will be here Monday. She is an incredibly bright, articulate young lady who knows a whole lot about Y2K. Let me tell you a little story. I got a very good quality Y2K check program today. And this program looked at every file in, you know, I have several computers, and I tentatively tried it on one computer. One computer, folks. And it's a high-class, whoop-de-doo, Y2K, fix-all-your-bugs kind of program. And you can do two operations. In operation one, it goes through and it checks all your files. Well, I had about, actually, I've got the copy somewhere, I don't know, thousands of files. And it went through and it found 25 Y2K-related bugs in my computer. So I then went ahead and did step two. This time I had to go through and fix each one of the 25 problems, which it did. But that's just to give you some idea of a fellow who owns a fairly modern computer with average to better software. you know, I've got a pretty good software. And I ran the program that I considered to be legit, and it found 25 and corrected 25 Y2K related problems. Pretty interesting, huh? So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen when the date actually turns. What am I hearing about Japan and others? April 1st was going to be some sort of date. And so far, the answer is I'm hearing nothing. What about you? I do hear of a lot of people, of course, with Y2K problems of one sort or another, of the sort I just described to you. There is messing around with the price of gasoline. Now, we all know that every summer the oil companies take advantage of us further, more than usual, by raising the price of gasoline because they know more people drive around in the summer and so they charge more. But somebody's really screwing with it this time. And I'm sure you've noticed the price of gas is skyrocketing. Why? Couple of refinery fires up in the Bay Area, I know about that, but I mean, my, it's really going up. Also, I've got a letter from Jason here, and I'm only going to read a small part of it because I want to confirm whether it is true or not. Jason from Orange County, California says, "Hey Art, are you aware that rationing of ammunition has begun? I went to the local gun store and was told by the owner that all his vendors that supply him now with ammo, particularly rifle ammunition, are limiting him to no more than 3,000 rounds per week total. Art, this has never happened. Never. This, in turn, of course, is driving prices up. So I have no way of confirming this except to make some calls myself, which I will tomorrow, and imploring any of you with information on the subject to tell me whether or not you know whether it is true. The price of gasoline in California, well, Jason says he spent $1.60, that's $1.60 a gallon for medium grade, and now paying almost $2 a gallon for premium. Now, again, I understand that what occurs around here in the summer, you know, I mean, the oil companies have always done this, but what the hell is going on out there? I smell a rat. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Oh, how are you, Art? I'm sorry, I was getting down the radio. I apologize. I have to grab it real quick.
All right, well, grab that
radio.
There
it's down.
All right, good.
Can you tell what kind of phone I'm on?
A good one.
Yeah, it's a Toshiba cordless.
It sounds good.
Yeah, this is Joe from Boston. I haven't spoke with you in a long time.
That's right. How you doing, Joe?
Not too good. Got the pictures of the cat out, but they'll get to you eventually. I was thinking of something. You had, first of all, before I ask my question, would you tell us how your power problem is? You forgot to mention that.
Well, no, I didn't forget to mention it. I said, I think that it's fixed, but you never know until, you know, until you operate for a while. I mean, we think we've got it, but I don't want to open my big mouth and
okay,
then find out some other piece of equipment was down. You know, this stuff has been here now for years, Joe, and some of us who are growing older, things begin to break down after a while.
You know, my question, you'll get the picture soon. My question is to you on the, remember a long time ago you had Captain Crunch?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I did the similar thing to what he did, and since it's getting near Y2K,
you did, Joe. You
yes?
used a blue box.
Not a blue box. A long time
you
ago.
You use a whistle. You
it was similar. It was similar. I was involved with kids.
You
and I
cheated the phone company.
I paid my dues to society like he did.
You cheated the phone company.
Apparently, it seemed that way.
Yeah.
But
Joe, oh Joe.
The reason I got
the phone company.
accidentally, and I paid my dues. You know what they're trying to do? They're trying to deny me a phone for my life, and I was wondering whether you'd be interested.
They're trying to deny you a phone for life because of what you did?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness, Joe.
And that's why I called.
That seems unreasonably harsh.
Everybody says that. That's why I asked you if you'd be willing to do something on it eventually with me. And now,
well, what would you have me do?
Well, have Captain Crunch and I tell our stories or similar.
Well, it didn't help Captain Crunch. Why do you think it'll help you?
Maybe if I get public awareness, I can get my own phone under my name instead of having to use other people's.
I see. Well, I'm sorry to hear about what you went through, Joe, but you screw with the Bell system, and they have a long, long memory. A very, very long memory. That's the Bell system. God, I love talk radio. All right. Well, anyway, I'm sorry that happened to Joe, but it's not the doing of it, Joe. It's the getting caught part. Anyway, we'll leave it there. I have no idea what otherwise to say to poor Joe, who's... That's like getting your license. That's like getting a bunch of speeding tickets and having them suspend your license, not for a month or a year, but for the rest of your natural life.
You will never again, ever drive a car. And if you're caught behind the wheel of one, you'll go to jail for the rest of your natural life. Imagine that. It's kind of like that with a telephone, I guess. Anyway, we'll break here, come right back, and go back to open lines once again. Anything you want to talk about on this program, as you know, is fair game. We don't screen calls. We don't know what's coming next. And actually, that's a lot of the fun. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from April 10th, 1999.
Other weird time zones besides Nepal would include, for example, Newfoundland, Tehran, Bombay, Calcutta, New Delhi, Darwin, and Adelaide in Australia. Now, they all are on the half hour. Did you know that? You can win money at bars with information like that. That and the guy they had on the world's... Anybody see the world's funniest videos the other day? They had this guy. If there's anybody else out there who can do it, I'd love to hear from you. But they demonstrated on video. This guy was able to stick out his tongue. Try it yourself. He was able to stick out his tongue and touch his eyebrow with it. Now, how about you? How can you do? Your best effort. I can't even get to the top of my mustache, much less my eyebrows. Can you imagine that? They showed it on video. Wouldn't have believed it unless I'd seen it with my own eyes. We're going to be talking to Nepal and Broughton Coburn at the top of the hour, who wrote a book called Everest Mountain Without Mercy. Did a lot of writing for National Geographic. It's really a fascinating topic. In the meantime, open lines. Back to open lines and who knows what. West of the Rockies, you're on the air, top of the morning.
Ah, evening, Art.
Whatever it is. Yes, hi.
I just had a thought that I was going to toss out to you.
A single thought or a multiple thought?
Well, just one thought.
One thought, all right. One thought.
The Kosovo War?
Yes.
You said something about them closing the borders.
Yes.
Well, I was just wondering, could it be possible that they would, the Serbs... spread some kind of a virus or something to the refugees, knowing that the rest of the world would take them in?
I don't know.
Just kind of occurred to me. I thought I'd talk
about
that.
What a horrid little thought. When you have them, you have real whiz bangers, don't you? That's horrible. So, in other words, by now your theory is that enough refugees have been scattered around the world to ensure the job is done, right?
Yeah. Wasn't there something also on the news about a whole field of them disappearing?
Oh, there's been all kinds of things on the news.
Yeah.
But your idea is horrid, sir. Horrid. Horrid.
I know. It would be bad.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. Sleep tight. Great. Actually, when you think about it, oh, my God. We live in such a strange world. Now, I don't even understand why the Serbs would be closing the border on their own. Why would they do that? They want the ethnic Albanians out, or that's the story we were getting, right? So why would they then suddenly close the border and do a 180? It just doesn't make any sense. Does it? First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
You are a first time caller, sir?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the show. Where are you?
This is Dave from Northeast Ohio.
All right, Dave. What's on your mind?
I listen to you on WKBN out of Youngstown.
Indeed.
I've been trying to get a hold of you for a while for two reasons. About 2.5 months ago on the Y2K issue.
Yes.
I received a notice from my local gas company.
And what did it say?
Well, it stated that I was ready to be disconnected.
What?
Yeah, but the ironic thing about it was it said I had to have my bill paid in full by January 1st, 00. And I called them and they said, well, their computer screwed up.
Well, were they threatening to disconnect you because you weren't paying them? Was that it?
No, actually, I was current. The computer just screwed up. But that was what the bill stated there, the paper stated.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to call you about was when you played the 911 tapes from Youngstown.
Oh, yes.
Okay, where I work is, I work less than 2,000 feet from Lake Erie.
Right.
And I'm in the middle of a 400-acre complex that it's a chemical treatment plant. And we have to go out and check the site on various times of the night just to make sure everything's, you know, there's nobody coming in the gates and whatnot. And,
right.
I was working one night, and I don't know what I saw in the sky, but something was up there. It was a series of flashing lights, and, I mean, where I was at, there was absolutely no noise anywhere near me. And the lights were just moving from one area over to another area, and you couldn't hear any noise whatsoever.
Is this like a human waste treatment plant?
No, it's more of a, we take in different chemicals and break them down. It's
maybe you had a chemical they had a particular interest in.
No, it wasn't anything from that. I hadn't been anywhere near any of the chemicals that night.
No, I didn't mean you personally.
Oh.
I meant the craft. In other words, at the treatment center there.
No, I like I said, I don't know what it was. It's the only time I ever saw it. This was probably 6 years ago or something like that.
Had it been human waste, I would have understood completely. E.T., you know, would have some sort of interest in human waste product. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, and take care. They would want to understand us from A to Z, and that would include the P for poop, right? Poop check. Hovering saucer. Wild card line, you're on the air.
Yeah, Art.
Yes.
This is Jeff from San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, Jeff.
How you doing?
Fine.
My mom works for the healthcare in the healthcare field, and
yes.
She received a memo that said there was going to be a couple of waves concerning the Y2K. And what they said is April 9th. Have you heard anything about that? What it is it's the 99th day of the year for the year 99. Excuse me.
Well, I heard some problems of 9999. I don't know. I've heard so many things. I don't know what's true anymore.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I hadn't heard you mention that. I was wondering if you knew.
Well, that's because I'm not sure it's true. It might be.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good morning. East of the Rockies.
Hi.
Sounds like you're in a rocket ship there.
Yeah, let me pull this big rig over here, Art.
Oh, you're in a big rig, huh?
Yes, I am.
Where are you, roughly?
I am in South Carolina right now.
Yep. As a matter of fact, you must be from the area because I can hear the south in your voice.
Okay, I'm stopped.
Oh, I heard your air brake go.
Right.
Very good.
I got a little bit of synchronicity for you.
Sure.
You know, you said something about April 1st and you mentioned Japan.
Yes.
Well, guess where Curtis was last week?
Japan?
Yes.
Oh,
he went over there
God.
Allegedly, and I mean allegedly, for a Guardian Angel conference.
What the hell would they have a Guardian Angel conference for in Japan?
I do not know, but that's exactly what he went over there for, is what he said.
Do you believe that?
No, I don't. Of course,
well,
you know.
Well, Rama will demand of him the accurate information, and I'll get it on the air.
Well, I sure do appreciate that.
I'm the only one that... he's the only one allowed to call me Rama.
Well, I'm still going to call you the Y2K master.
All right, crank that sucker back up.
All right, thanks, Art. Thanks
for the call, and take care. Curtis in Japan? Curtis in Japan? What are you doing with Guardian Angels in Japan? Japan is a very well-behaved nation. And as a matter of fact, their subways are spotlessly clean. You don't even find any Japanese graffiti on subways in Japan. So what would Curtis be doing over there? Bears some investigation. International Line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Art. I wanted to comment on something you mentioned on a previous show about an explosion looked an awful lot, and that occurred in Serbia that looked an awful lot like a nuclear explosion.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I got so much email on that with people agreeing with me. They too saw it.
Yeah.
Did you see it?
No, but I heard something. I remember reading about something a long time ago about the American government taking an interest in what's called micronuclear explosion, like trying to create the same thing but on a much smaller scale, like that would substitute for powerful munitions for aircraft use.
Well, there's fuel air explosive, and that's nearly nuclear. But anything that would have radiation, in other words, that would be a chain reaction, would be easily detectable. And so this obviously was not nuclear, but I'm telling you right now, it looked nuclear.
I don't doubt you at all.
And if CNN had shown me that film, that strip, and they'd said this was a nuclear detonation, I would have bought it hook, line, and sinker.
It must bear some kind of resemblance to some of the design of a nuclear weapon in some way, maybe a shaped charge or something, specially designed to produce that intensity or something. But there was also talk about creating weapons that would create the EMP pulse for damaging electronics as well.
I know, but how do you do that? How do you make an EMP pulse without a nuclear detonation?
Oh, they must have had some kind of design feature that would create it, you know, some kind of resonance at a certain range of frequencies that would just give a huge pulse. It's like a sudden burst from a transmitter or something.
Right. I understand. There are huge bursts that we get of all kinds of energy, but they don't, at any distance, do EMP damage. So we must have some new weapon that we don't know about that we're trying out over there. The Russians wrote a story about that, you know. They contended we were indeed using a new weapon, and we probably are. I wonder what it is. What have we got? What have we got? First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hey, Art. On that EMP pulse thing.
Yes.
I saw something on MSNBC, I think it was.
Yes.
And they had actually admitted that we have a new type of weapon that they had already used.
Oh, apparently so. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So now that just proves the theory that we have all kinds of things that we really don't know about.
Of course we do. Did you ever doubt that for a second?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah. And apparently this is serious enough, what they're doing, to justify bringing it out of the closet. Because once you get it out of the closet, then, of course, other people figure out how to make it. So they tend to hold on to this stuff until they have a really big reason to use it.
To me, this looks like just a big show where we show everybody how big and bad we really are, and I don't know. It's really frightening.
Well, here's what I would ask, and I really do mean this sincerely. How now is this supposed to end? In other words, we bomb, we bomb, we bomb, we bomb, we bomb, and then we bomb until he finally, Milosevic, finally says, okay, troops can come in and enforce the peace. So that means we put troops in on the ground from now until doomsday, roughly. Well, is that about it?
I look at it as if, you know, if we're the ones leading this situation, or NATO is leading the situation, all the countries of NATO should be responsible for the refugees. You know?
Well, many of them are taking refugees. But what I mean is, then we're going to have to be there forever, holding everybody apart, putting our service people in harm's way, trying to keep the peace. And they're going to be there forever. Just like they're going to be there forever in Bosnia. And pretty soon we're not going to have enough troops to keep every place forever.
It's a terrible, it's an unfortunate incident. I just think it's a real mixed up situation. And it's exploiting something that we shouldn't be exploiting.
Well, I happen to agree with that position. Now, I understand that the Serbs are no doubt committing atrocities. Although I suspect not as many as we're getting. In other words, we're being fed propaganda here, too. Don't you for one second, as I said the other night, think that we're not getting fed propaganda, because we are. All sides engage in propaganda. It's part of war. Every bit as much as dropping bombs and anything else the military does, propaganda is as big a tool of war as are bombs. So you've got to be careful what you believe. Wild Card Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, this is Gordy from Pahrump.
Gordy, Pahrump,
yep.
Here in my own town.
You betcha. Yeah, and I called to ask you if you received the album I sent you from John Serry that we talked about at that Y2K thing the other day.
Oh, yes, we had a Y2K forum here in Pahrump. And the answer is I have not yet gone to the post office.
Oh.
So I'm sure that I have it, and as soon as we go to the post office and carry away the bins of mail that we get, I'll have it.
Oh, okay.
But everybody, this fellow's correct. We met, I went to a Y2K forum here in Pahrump. And by the way, I'd like to note that for our little Pahrump, boy, there was a hell of a turnout, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were. There's quite a lot of people, and that was just the early part.
I understand.
It was open until 6. Well, I went back around 04 or 4:30, and there were still quite a lot of people there.
Oh, I know. It was really something. All right, my friend, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll look forward to it. Yeah, we had a forum here. Pretty bright lady decided to have a forum, and they had all kinds of things there, how to independently pump water out of your well, how to grow things inside at a great rate, you know, some sort of modified hydroponics. They had people there with a solution to just about every problem you might encounter if. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
Sasquatch here in Chico.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Listen on the mighty KPAY.
That's it, all right.
Yes, I was just a comment. Well, hello to Greg listening down at the AMPM here in Chico, and I know he's no doubt astounded I got through.
You're not supposed to do that, you know, but it came out before I could stop you.
Well, all right, I'm sorry. I should stay away from commercial endorsements, but about the EMP,
yes.
You know, the night the bombing started, the first thing we did was we flew an Aurora over Belgrade, and just zapped them with an EMP. We have a pulse generator. There's no question about that.
Oh, I believe it's true, but how do you imagine that could be done? What kind of technology, short of nuclear, would produce an EMP of that strength?
Of that strength. You
that's
just
the key
hit
phrase.
The right word.
I know.
We have
I mean,
a pulse generator, and well,
the
you,
police
you
right
saw
now.
The STS-80, right?
The police. Yes, I did. The police right now are working. Actually, have something that almost works. Will stop your car in its tracks
yes.
with an EMP.
Well,
I know about that, but boy, we're talking about such a scale here that it's hard to believe that they. What kind of power source could drive something that big?
A satellite. And this is a directed satellite through the, not AWACS, but through the Aurora. And Aurora is hovering around, you know, just loitering, being silent and, of course, unobserved. And Aurora gets the pickup from the satellite and downloads it into Belgrade or whatever the target is. And zap, your lights go out. They can do that to them. They can do it to us.
So are you saying that the EMP pulse was generated from the satellite, not the Aurora?
Yes. No, the Aurora is just the carrier, just like the phone company. Isn't that scary?
How do you know this to be true, just out of curiosity?
I'm a military analyst.
By the way, Mr. Analyst, turn your radio off, please.
Oh, well, yes. I'm working my way over there, Art. When you subscribe to the range of magazines that I subscribe to, including Soldier Fortune, in fact, I'd love to hear you with Robert K. Brown. If you could interview the editor at Soldier of Fortune magazine.
Really?
Yeah, he's way, way out in front of most American media. In fact, all of American media. And the print media.
I would do that.
Yeah, Robert K. Brown will be a fabulous guest for you if you can get him to stay up that late into the night. You know, soldiers rise early and bed down pretty early. And Robert K. Brown, former colonel, Colonel retired. He would be a good interview for you because he can tell you things that are happening before they happen.
I wonder how the Russians feel about observing the fact that we have a non-nuclear EMP weapon.
Oh, they hate us.
They must not like that one bit.
No, not one bit, because they know we can neutralize everything. Their entire Blue Water fleet, their entire air fleet, their entire rocket forces. And they really must be very shaky about that.
Well,
and the Chinese as well. But the Chinese being, you know, the Chinese, they're playing their cards very close to their vest.
Yes, well, they do that. All right, thank you very much. That is big news, you know, that we have a new weapon. And I think we do have a new weapon. Something that generates an EMP big enough to knock out a city's electronics. Let me think that one over a little bit.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 10th of April, 1999.
All right, we were just in Egypt for an hour, kind of previewing what you're going to be seeing tomorrow night on Fox Live. Pretty gutsy show, actually, after what happened to Geraldo. They're going to be opening a number of very sacred places in Egypt live on Fox Television, two-hour special tonight. Most time zones now, except here in the West. That should really be something. In a moment, we're going to Australia, and we're going to talk with Stan Dale. Those of you who know Stan, actually, you know what? It's been so long since we've had Stan on, I think we're going to have to sort of go over his background a little bit, tell you who Stan Dale is. Joining us tonight, for the first time, new affiliates, WTBG-FM in Brownsville, Texas. Oh, I know Brownsville. I spent a lot of time in Texas, some courtesy of the Air Force, and I know Brownsville. 95.3 on the FM dial there. Big 5 kilowatts. Generally a music station, but they'll be taking Coast overnights anyway. Smart move. WNWS-FM in Jackson, Tennessee. They're 101.5 megahertz. Hey, you know, that's getting to be quite the thing, isn't it? There's two FM stations joining the network. And I have a feeling that's kind of the way it's going right now. FM is beginning to open its eyes and realize that ratings, there's a lot of good ratings in talk. And there's kind of a transition underway with talk radio. Have you noticed that? I mean, look at this. I've got three affiliates, two of them FM. Brownsville, Tennessee. Did I say? I said Texas. Huh? Brownsville, Tennessee. I'm sorry, TN is Tennessee. Well, that was Texas. I know Brownsville, Texas. I don't know Brownsville, Tennessee, and Jackson, Tennessee. So two in Tennessee and WGSV AM in Guntersville, Alabama. Welcome. And also, by the way, KJFK, our affiliate down in Austin, Texas, has begun to pick up refeeds at 10 o'clock Texas time. That's absolutely excellent. We are now officially at 428 affiliates and going fast. Many more in the works, and It will be made public soon. It will be the largest, I'll let you know when the moment arrives, but officially, at some point soon, we will be the largest overnight radio program in America's history. That should be rather interesting. We are either past that point or approaching that point, depending on whose point of view you take right now. So we are at a very interesting juncture in the program. At any rate, coming up from Australia, in a moment, it used to be Perth, but he's got a new home now, Stan Dale. So stay right where you are, because you really are in for a ride. Once again, WTBG-FM, Brownsville, Tennessee, not Texas, welcome, 95.3 on the dial. A music station and extending the hand of welcome to Talk Now. WNWS-FM in Jackson, Tennessee, and WGSV-AM in Guntersville, Alabama. And then, of course, our friends KJFK. As you know, the program, and it seems to have been a very wise move, a lot of people are jumping on it, the program is pre-fed now every night, beginning at 6 o'clock Pacific time for those stations that would like to take it. And, of course, the reason I think it's working so well is that last night's show, or Friday's show in this case, comes up and meets Monday's show, and it sort of all joins together, and those who didn't get to stay up late get to hear the show. So we do pre-feed now, and if you would like your station to be part of that, to be able to hear the show a little bit earlier every night, just give your affiliate a call, because we do provide that service. News-wise, some very interesting news. Guess what, folks? Let me read it to you as is from Reuters News. Hackers have seized control of one of Britain's military communication satellites and have issued blackmail threats. This was printed in the Sunday Business newspaper. The newspaper, quoting security sources, said the intruders, check this out, altered the course of one of Britain's four satellites that are used by defense planners and military forces around the world. The sources said the satellite's course was changed just over 2 weeks ago. Oh my, haven't we been keeping quiet about this? The hackers then issued a blackmail threat, demanding money to stop interfering with the satellite.
Ooh.
One military intelligence source said this is a nightmare scenario. They say if Britain were to come under nuclear attack, an aggressor would first interfere with military communication systems. Well, gee, if a few little hackers can get hold of your satellite, move it in its position in space and hold it hostage, guys, what do you suppose the Russians can do? Or should we be hiring these little guys to do this to the Russians? Anyway, they're regarding this as very serious. Quote, this is not just a case of computer nerds mucking about. This is very serious, and the blackmail threat has made it even more serious. Police say they would not comment, as the investigation was simply too sensitive to talk about. A Ministry of Defense spokesman made no comment whatsoever. So, basically, the headline is, hackers have got a British satellite. We now have as many as six dead from strep in the Chicago area. Have you been hearing about that? As many as six have died, another seven have been sickened by strep bacteria in the Chicago area in recent months. And they're just announcing it now? Three different strains of the bacteria are to blame, leading health officials to play down the possibility the cases might be linked. Now, wait a minute here. We've got six dead and seven sickened, and they're saying that the cases are not linked and they're all in Chicago? Victims include an 18-month-old boy, a man in his 40s who died of necrotizing fasciitis, I believe it is. I'll never pronounce that right, sometimes called the flesh-eating bacteria, and a 90-year-old man who died of toxic shock syndrome. But they're saying that they're not connected. And what they are saying is that these clusters, though unusual, do occur. Now, that's what they always say. If you want to believe that, go right ahead. That's too much of a coincidence for me. Americans should prepare for the year 2000 computer bug like they would a hurricane. Now, is that from Art Bell? No, it is not. That's from Reuters News, and it's from the U.S. Senate. That's right. Let me read you the Reuters story as is. Americans should prepare for the year 2000 computer bug like they would a hurricane by stocking up on canned food and bottled water in case vital services are cut off. Senators leading a congressional study of that problem said on Sunday. Matter of fact, they said it on, I believe, on Meet the Press. They went on, global trade could also be disrupted because major U.S. trading partners, including Japan and oil producers Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, may not be able to address the computer glitch in time. That was Utah Republican Senator Robert Bennett and Connecticut Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd. Bennett said, quote, the problem is real. This will not be the end of the world as we know it, he said, but we've got to stay on top of it. Dodd, Senator Dodd, told NBC's Meet the Press, quote, it's not unwise for people to do a little stockpiling, end quote. You know, bottled water, canned goods, other essentials. So this time, no matter what you may hear, though everybody's trying to say, well, Art Bell's scaring the hell out of everybody, I'm not the only one saying that a little preparation might be in order, and that's all I've ever said, that a little preparation might be in order. And now, I guess you can come to your own conclusions, but when frontline senators say this kind of thing, when they begin to talk about stockpiling, when was the last time you heard any U.S. senator say that we should be stockpiling for any reason whatsoever? Do you ever recall anything like that? So Art Bell now is not the only one saying it. Gary North is not the only one saying it, though we certainly are coming under fire for panic mongering and all the rest of it. Now we've got the U.S. Senate saying it, and I don't think anybody knows for sure what the hell's going to happen come the year 2000. But everybody is saying basically the same thing. That is everybody who has looked into this a little bit, and that is some prudent preparations would be in order. And I'm going to keep saying it. Even though on certain programs, I'm sure I'm getting clobbered, as usual, because I've been on this for a very long time now. It is good, though, to see the U.S. Senate beginning to make statements that will alert the American people. Incidentally, they did a test on a nuke plant that failed on February 8, 1999, while performing testing for a Y2K remediation modification to the Unit 2 Rod Worth Minimizer system. This is in Pennsylvania. Peach Bottom Unit 2 nuclear reactor power plant experienced a lockup of both the primary and backup plant monitoring systems, computers. As a result, operators also lost the following PMS supported systems for about 7 hours. This, folks, is a nuclear power plant. They knew the PMS computers, were not Y2K, I won't say anything about that, were not Y2K compliant, but the engineers believed it would not impact the testing. Well, guess what? Surprise. All right. I had to get all of that out. All of that's pretty important stuff. Let's go down now to Australia and Stan Dale. Stan, you're not in Perth, Australia anymore, and I forget where you are now. Where are you?
How could you forget? I'm sitting at the base of a volcano in Ballarat, Australia.
That's the name I couldn't remember. I'm sorry. I knew you were at the base of a volcano, which, as I recall, you didn't discover until you moved there.
Yes, that was very cleverly done, I thought.
Stan, a lot of my audience, or at least some of them, will not know who you are because we have so many new radio stations joining us. So if you could give us a Standale 101, would you please?
Sure, Art. As far just on the subject of radio programs and affiliates joining, we're working down here at the moment to get you on air down here across Australia. We've been dealing with 9 radio stations here, country stations, who want to take your show and delay it about 8 hours and put people on down here to ask you questions for the next show, you know, the day after.
As you know, I would absolutely love that. I'm really, really, really looking forward to the opportunity to being on to be on the air in Australia and also in Great Britain, and we're working very hard on all of that right now. So, knock on wood, Stan, I thank you for all your good work. I hope it happens.
Well, I think it will. It's we're certainly getting down to the negotiating stages now. Then, now, as far as my background, I was born in the United States in Texas, in Clifton, Texas, near Valley Mills, and I moved to Dallas, lived there most of my life, and then went to a couple of years at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado. I left the Air Force, or retired from the Air Force in 1968. I went back to Dallas, trained at IBM to program computers. I know for sure I'm responsible for part of the Y2K bug problems in the insurance industry, because that's where I programmed. But to be quite honest, in those days, no one ever thought about the fact that we would have to go all the way to 1999 with these programs. We thought sure they'd be thrown away and replaced by then. I was hired, kind of contracted, I suppose is the word, by the FBI for a short period in Dallas to spy on some corporations that were my clients in the computer industry.
Wait a second. Whoa. You were hired by the FBI to spy on corporations that you were working for?
Yeah. There were 700 of us.
I didn't know that. Why would the FBI hire anybody to spy on the corporations that they worked for? I mean, what was the... Can you tell us about that at all?
Well, yeah, I guess I think I've mentioned this before. It's probably one of my books or something. But what happened was that my family had been in a kind of patriot... awareness movements and published a lot of books for folks to try to wake up Americans to the fact that we were going to have problems in our government if we didn't watch who was taking over the government. And we were probably the major force trying to wake up the American people to the Illuminati, you know, the conspiracy thing. And as a result, well, when I was at the academy, I had top secret security clearance. And when I came out, the FBI found that I was working for a corporation that was dealing in the Middle East and in Texas, and in fact, in many of the states in the United States. And there were things going on there, this was during the Nixon administration, that were not exactly kosher. And I was visited one day in my office there by 2 FBI agents from Dallas. And, you know, they showed me their ID, shut the door, and said, okay, look, we've checked on your security levels and your family and whatever, and we'd like to ask you a favor, because you're sitting here in an office where we can't get anybody right now, you know, without being too obvious.
Right.
And you're sitting out here on executive row, and you hear a lot of things, and we're in a big hurry to find out what's happening on a couple of issues. So, you know, they said, we can do this for a fee, or we can do it for however you want to do it. And I said, well, as a patriot, I'll do it for information. I give you information. I want information on things I'm interested in, you know, technology and things like that.
Oh, really? So you made a deal with the FBI?
Yeah.
Their concerns were that these corporations were doing something that was not good for our national security. I take it that was why they approached you?
Oh, yes, most certainly.
All right, well, I'm sure you can't give specifics, but it's interesting that you would listen to their pitch and then, instead of going for the money, go for information instead.
Well, it's a two-way street. I was working on a couple of things that I needed to have some more input on, and you're not going to find it down at the library. An energy conversion system and a flying saucer propulsion system.
Yes. Well, as I recall, when President Clinton took office, and some other presidents, I think the first two questions they had were, who shot Kennedy, and are flying saucers real? Now, the presidents may not have received that information. I guess you got more than some of the some of our presidents got. Hold on, Stan. We'll be right back to you. A short first section. I can't get by that. Boy, he made a deal with the FBI. Made a deal with the FBI. To find out about propulsion systems and what's really going on out there, in a moment, we'll ask what he found out.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Sandeo, we'll be right back. I'm going to go get my globe so I can see actually in Australia where Stan is. Bring that in and make him tell me exactly where he is in Australia. So you might go get a globe and join with me as we try and find Stan. Listen, Joe in Detroit, Michigan sent me the following, and we're going to follow up with Stan on this in a little while. Art, today on a local radio station, I heard an ad calling for persons with pneumonia-like symptoms. I said pneumonia-like symptoms to call 1-877-LUNGS-99 so they can possibly receive a free test or treatment. The survey is available in Spanish or English. Here's another one of these. God. Joe says, this is terrifying. The government could be testing chemicals on us and using us as lab rats. Could it be related to the contrails? I don't know. But I'm telling you right now, I think that something strange is going on here. I have a lot of friends, and a couple of them have very, very serious cases of pneumonia right now. And they're not doing very well with it. They're on antibiotics, and they're not exactly clearing it up very quickly, and we're hearing about all kinds of respiratory problems and all of these strange lines they're setting up to do surveys and maybe offer free treatment. And what the hell is going on? Anyway, I'm going to go get my globe right now while you listen to the following, and Stan Deo will be right back. I got my globe, Stan, and it looks to me like Australia is divided up into Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, the Northern Territories, and Western Australia. Where do you fit in?
I'm in Victoria, in the southeast corner of the country.
Wow, you're really down there. Damn, Stan.
Yeah, when we say the other side of the earth, we mean it.
Yeah, you're actually not all that far from the Antarctic. You're at one of the closest points to the Antarctic. If I look across to South America, it looks to me like you're a whole lot, or just about as close, if not closer, to the Antarctic. How's the sun down there?
Oh, it's fine. We have a solar hot water heater on the house.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant with the ozone hole and all the rest of it.
Well, that part of it's very bad. We have in our evening news and weather reports, we have the UV index, and it hardly ever gets out of the extreme danger of 12 to 15 or better.
My God.
People down here ignore it, though. I mean, they still go out without hats, and they don't put their sunscreen on. They don't wear sunglasses all the time, and cancers are picking up.
Holy smokes. 12? You said 12 to 15?
Yep. Oh, yeah. 12 is kind of average here.
God, you know what? I live in the desert. We've got a lot of sun, and we get threes and fours a lot. I've actually got a little test kit myself, and I can go out there and take a look. But it's typically three and four, 12 to 15. Good Lord. All right. I see Melbourne. Where would you be from there?
Well, if you've got your finger on Melbourne, then go west about, I don't know the size of your map, but
looks to me, if you go
called Ballarat.
Yeah, if you go, well, no, that's not on my globe. But if I go west from Melbourne, it looks like it's out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, we're on the edge of the back of beyond. if I drive about maybe an hour, we're into the desert. But we have very nice weather where we are because we're up next to the mountain range.
And of course, let's see, it's wintertime here, so I guess it's summertime now there, is it not?
Well, that's what they've been telling us, and certainly we've had the third year of drought here for the area we're in, and we get the odd sprinkle certainly it's been a dry summer even for Ballarat, which we chose for the rainfall. The other places around the country are really having problems, either with extreme flooding on the northeast coast or drought, like over in Perth, where their water storage is down to around 30% or lower.
All right. Well, listen, let's go back now. Born in Texas, working for some companies, the FBI comes to you and says, we need you to do some work for us. And you say, okay, fine, I'll do it. I'm a patriot, but I want some information of my own. And what did they say? I mean, what kind of, I can hardly imagine that meeting.
Well, I mean, it was kind of lighthearted because when they first came in, I said, oh, gee, blimey, what, I make a mistake in my income tax or what? And they didn't laugh a lot, but...
No, they're actually, I've also talked with a lot of agents, and they don't exactly have the same sort of sense of humor that a lot of us do.
No, you can say that again. And especially when they sit down and move their coat back, and you know, you can see the holster and the weapon stuff, and sit down and say, yeah, Mr. Deo, blah blah blah. You know, you think, whoa.
I know. I've had them at the house doing exactly that, and you make a little joke, and they sit there absolutely stone faced, like a British palace guard, and you say,
yeah.
You say to yourself, okay, this is going to be interesting.
Oh, listen. Remind me. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I had another episode with the Australian equivalent of the FBI, kind of sort of here. We'll tell you about that in a minute. It just happened last week. All right. When you were talking about the deal with the FBI there, Holly reminded me that I hadn't prefaced that with the deal at the Academy where I was in the mind control or the programming experiments, because somehow or another I think all that was linked together, you know, even with the FBI stuff later.
What exactly what kind of mind control?
Well, at the Academy, at least myself, I don't know how many others they were doing it to, we would be taken off... one class I had, there was probably about 60 of us into a little theaterette, and they would have us look at a screen,
yes,
a projection screen, and then let the lights go down low and tell us that when they told us to open our eyes, you'd close them until they told us to open them, and when we opened our eyes, to focus on this black dot up on that screen, and for us not to blink at all until they tell us. And, you know, then we'd do that, and there'd be a pause, and they'd say, all right, open your eyes, focus on the dot, hold them. I need to hear this kind of whoo sound up behind you,
yeah,
as this kind of chrome-plated gizmo would fire images onto this screen so fast that all we could see was like kind of smooth clouds of static, you know, of noise. I mean, and what it was several hundred pages of data being programmed into our minds in a few seconds. The problem was, as we learned later, that although it goes into your brain and is stored, you have not assimilated it into your knowledge base, and that has to happen when you sleep over the next few nights or weeks or whatever. And
so, did they actually want you to learn this stuff, Stan, or were they using you sort of like a computer storage database?
No, they wanted us to learn this. I had to wait until I came to Australia, and I met with the head of the Aeronautical Research Labs here as part of my work down here, and they explained to me what had happened was that it was part of experiments that the government was doing in the States to tune minds to do, I think, what Dames and some of the other guys are talking about, to remote view other scientists and things like that to see what they're building, what kind of equipment and stuff. And so they trained our minds, you know, to, like, in other words, on command, we could tune our minds to listen in and see what everybody else is doing on a particular subject or field or something like that.
So that's what the material was?
Well, the material that I remember, well, when I say I remember, I don't remember it coming across the screen, but in the classroom, on the first test we had, they shot this stuff across, and then the instructor got up and said, okay, now does anybody remember what we just looked at?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we all laughed, which is, you know, in military, you don't really laugh at your commanding officer or whoever there, but we did, and he says, no, gentlemen, quiet. He says, now I'm going to give you some clues and see if you remember anything. And then he'd say something like, you know, red, and nobody said anything. And okay, scarf, and nobody said anything. And then street post or lamp post. And with that, stretch up behind me, the tall, skinny guy, he jumped up and he said, sir, I see it. I see a page floating in the air.
Wow.
And he said, read it to us. And so the guy started reading it from the air. There was
wow.
Nothing there for us. It was just in his mind. And he read, and then the instructor flashed up on the screen the page he just read about this girl standing next to a lamppost in this dark city and had a scarf on and was waiting for a guy or something. It was just a piece of fiction, right? But he had photographic memory just that quick. And he said, now you all have this in your minds. This is it locked in there. And sometimes we'd be hypnotized. I can remember going into the room and then at the end saying, yes, sir, good night, sir, and walk out, you know, after having been programmed. I don't know what they put in there. There's absolutely no way. But
Stan,
later
is,
on.
Is this something you volunteered for?
No.
You didn't volunteer for it?
Oh, no. No. There were people, there were officers there that were against that, and one of them did try his best to help me not get caught up in the whole program, I think, one of my math teachers, but bad stuff, bad stuff. Anyway, it was an experiment, and I gained a lot of knowledge of projects, I'm reasonably certain, including the flying saucer stuff, that I would not have otherwise had. I saw those things floating in the air like the color movies and stuff on demand. When I got down to Australia, working, you know, after I left the FBI thing, whatever, working for the people that had recruited me in Dallas, Dr. Edward Teller's people, on circular winged aircraft, flying saucers, developing them. And, you know, the only reason I was able to do that was because I saw the things working in 3D expandable models, like a CAD-CAM system. It would use about 5:30 in the morning when I was just waking up. I'd have a movie theater there in my mind watching it.
What did the FBI actually come back to you with? What did they actually tell you about?
Well, a little bit of technology, a little bit of information on the what was going on in the state politically, which would help me to do my job because I know what they were after more. Hoover, as you know, was a little bit of a strange fellow most of the time, but.
Yeah.
He had very strict rules inside the Bureau, and he certainly ran a tight ship in that respect. Anyway, he'd codenamed the project Operation Illuminati to find out more about it. And they explained a few things to me, you know, that I didn't know about how mafia money and various other kinds of money were being laundered through this particular group of companies I was working for, and weapons purchases were being sent to the Middle East, and this is a long time before, you know, the Middle East was a big deal for most folks. They didn't care. And we were looking at arms shipments being done under the nose of various export rules in the United States illegally and, you know, large things like aircraft and munitions that were quite serious.
Wouldn't having information like that, Stan, potentially put you in dire danger? I mean, knowing that our government was involved with mafia and money laundering and all the rest of that?
Well, I didn't listen to that part when they hired me. the answer to the question is yes. Being a young man and, you know, full of vinegar and all that kind of stuff, I said, "Shay, sure, that'll be great. Let's do it. You know, I'll play the game. And where, how's my contact supposed to be made? And, you know, how do I pass information, all that kind of stuff?" What happened was, there was a war going on inside the FBI, the pro-Hooverites, anti-Hooverites, or the pro-Nixonites, the anti-Nixonites, whatever, I don't know how you want to say it. But I knew anyway before I left because the FBI guys told me that their side, which was Hoover's side, was losing and that Nixon would either have him replaced or he would die, you know, very shortly, which he did within a year. He did die. But not that I'm pointing a finger at Nixon or anybody else. I'm just telling you that there was that kind of a war going on inside the agency itself, the Bureau. And the government, what really got me in trouble and did nearly get me aced was a helicopter landed on our parking lot one day at the company there in Dallas, and it's a big parking lot, but and a bunch of men came running out in suits and were bustled into an office next to me. And it took me a couple of days to figure out who they were, but I did find out by kind of putting my purposes at risk by exposing myself, that they were men from Nixon's office. It was Murray Schottner, who was the predecessor to Haldeman, and the Washington regional director for the FBI under Hoover, who had not checked into the Dallas regional area. He just sneaked in. But I didn't know this. I just got names of people and turned it over. And my agent wasn't in the usual
contact place, so I rang in on the FBI phone and from another phone, a pay phone, and said, look, I have a message which is fairly important for my contact. And they said, well, give it to us and we'll pass it on. I said, well, okay, fine, and I did. And my agent later contacted me in the usual manner and said, you know, you silly boy, and he did it in a little bit more terse terms than that. But he said, I told you not to use those lines of communication. He says, do you realize what you've done? And I said, no, I gave you what you wanted to know, the names of those guys from the White House. And he says, yeah, well, here's what you've done. You've put us all at risk because, you know, we were monitoring something that was a war inside the FBI. And anyway, he said, I don't know what's going to happen now. But he said, remember I told you that you might be at risk? He says, well, you're at risk now. Watch your back. And so within a few weeks of that, they managed to make some plans for me to exit and go to Australia if I would like to go there.
And so that accounts for your going to Australia in the first place.
No, that's only part of it. Right around the same time, Dr. Teller's people came, sent a man to meet me at that same company, strangely enough, coincidentally. And he makes my acquaintance at a table down in the canteen, and he tells me, look, I have a friend that wants to talk to you, Dr. Maxfield. And I didn't go the first time. Second time I did, because things were getting a bit tense, and I thought, well, I might as well die here or somewhere else, but I'll go see what they want. And that's another story, the meeting, but I did meet with Dr. Teller there at his X-ray radiation research place in Dallas, and he explained about the South Pole, the under ice, the flying saucer base that we had there, that he and Teller had overseen something like 50-some-odd projects since the mid-50s. And we had two or three different types of propulsion systems, and I was going to make a great addition to their team, and, you know, everybody just assumed I was going to Australia, FBI and these guys, and I don't know whether they were talking or not, but when you get two knocks on the head like that, you think, well, time to get out of Dodge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I packed up the family, and I was sent tickets, and everything was paid by, you know, the Australian government, whatever. I was part of Maxfield's boys, so that was all arranged ahead of time. And I bolted about a week ahead of time for my last meetings with everybody and just took my family for a Sunday drive and never came home and landed in Sydney and then talked to a commercial pilot there who was taking another flight down and said, look, can we jump onto your ship and keep on going? And he said, fine. And I was just trying to disappear for a while, which we did.
Okay, well, you had to have been in some degree of rather immediate fear for your safety or that of your family to have done something like that, Stan. Is that fair?
You got that right. Let me tell you, I was introduced to fear in a big way. I don't want to repeat.
There was just an HBO original movie that ran here this last week about Meyer Lansky, who was a famous figure in the mafia. And
no, it was his people I was watching.
Oh, you happen to see that? Okay.
No. I say it was his people I was watching in Dallas.
Exactly. That's exactly where I was going. Meyer Lansky alluded to the fact many times that he had done actually a great deal for his country. Now, in that he meant that he did some gun running. He did a lot of things that helped our country. And he did those things in concert with the FBI or the CIA. And that there's been a long running deal between the mafioso and our three-letter agencies. Do you think that's still going on?
Well, it was certainly going on then. I'm not in the agency now or even working for them anyway, so I couldn't tell you. But I doubt that it would have stopped just, you know, because government's changed, because that was somewhat of a trans-government institution.
Trans-government institution.
Well, look, for instance, you elect a president, you elect senators and House representatives, same thing we do down here. But you don't hire and fire every civil servant in every department, all the military, each time you change the heads of government. There's a show in England, it's a comedy situation, comedy called Yes Minister. And it treats this, and it applies to America as well as to England, but you have the senator or the minister, the secretary of this or secretary of that at a government level, and you see how he kind of says to his advisors, okay, what do I do next? Do I smile? Do I turn around? Do I jump up and down? Okay,
They tell him everything to do.
Somebody's pulling the strings. All right, Stan, hold on. We're going to break here at the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
Some kind of awesome piece of music, huh? That's Neil Diamond. That's what Stan did. Kind of the opposite, though. The exact opposite. Is the freedom we have all a big illusion? I certainly hope not. That'd be pretty hard to take. And yet so many people that I have on this program seem to indicate that's the... That's the case. And if that's the case, that's pretty sad, huh? Anyway, Stan will be right back. We're going to try to touch on a few other things and then get the lines open for you if we can, because there's a lot to talk about. To Stan in Australia, way down south, way, way down south. So we have you now in Australia. I guess running to Australia is a fair comment. Running away to Australia, getting whisked away to Australia, a little ahead of when even they were going to send you for reasons of personal security. At that point, Stan, what would you say it was that you knew? That I don't know how detailed you can get in what you're going to tell us, that had you in such jeopardy.
Well, this was before Watergate, about a year before Watergate started, something like that. And part of the information I had was certainly not putting Nixon's administration in a good light if it came to the open at that time. In retrospect, historical view, it might not have been so bad. But at that time, that information and what was going on with the agency and with the mafia and various other things might have led a trail back to the Kennedy assassination as well. So for that, I was probably in trouble. And my FBI agent told me that, you know, one of them said, I wish I could go with you because as soon as Hoover goes, there's going to be a big house cleaning here in the Bureau. And he said... Once you get down there, you're on your own. We none of us will be able to help you anymore. You're on your own. Goodbye, God bless. You know, when Hoover is gone, watch your backside.
When Hoover is...
So you can understand it years, a couple years later anyway, when I was in a public eating place down in Melbourne, and I ran into another American, older, with gray hair, and he was a tourist down there, and he says, oh, hey, your accent, you're from America, aren't you? And I said, yes. I didn't know him from a bar of soap, and he says... Yeah, so am I. I'm down here on holidays. He says, whereabouts you from? And I said, Dallas, Texas. He says, no, you're not. You're from Colorado, probably close to Colorado Springs. I said, no, I'm not. You're wrong. And he said, don't tell me I'm wrong. He said, I work for the FBI. And I kind of must have gone a little bit pale. And he says, you know, that's my job. I listen to people's accents and word usage, and I analyze phone calls for terrorist bomb threats, and I can tell them, probably down to the town where these people come from. I said, yes. Well, gee, you're wrong in this case. I said, the only time I was there in Colorado Springs was 2 years at the academy, at the Air Force Academy. He says, well, my boy, he says, that is your accent. It overrode every other thing you had before that. And sometimes, I guess after that, I wondered, and I never saw the guy again. He walked off. He really wasn't after me. He was just a fluke. scared the life out of me. But anyway, I wondered if the deal at the academy didn't change my accent, you know, with all the programming. I certainly don't sound like, you know, most everybody else in my family anymore.
All right. Well, you know a lot about propulsion systems. You know a lot about what we were doing. What can you tell the audience about what you really do know? Now, bear in mind, everybody, this information goes back a ways. We're talking about information that Stan got. What year roughly?
19... 19- Well, it started in 1971.
1971. So, tell us.
And at that time, we already had 50 other projects that were doing similar type development of aircraft and spacecraft.
What kind of spacecraft, Stan?
Flying saucers. There were just a lot of people had different ideas about how to make them work. Some anti-gravity, some plasma craft, things like that. And each project had its merits, and they didn't all last, but they were funded to try to get to that position of power as quickly as possible.
Well, did we get there? I mean, what is the latest information you have? Did we actually get one of these working?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Heck yeah. There were three different main propulsion systems. I was recruited mainly not because they needed me to develop a new one. It was because I found out later they didn't want me to go down the street trying to hawk it and sell it to people because it would compromise security on what they already had. And that was a plasma craft. Just hot air shot around a saucer-shaped craft up through the top of it and over the wing, guided by magnetic fields of coils inside, and then taken back into the underside of the craft and spun around in a chamber and back up out the outside again. It sounds fairly simple, but there were a lot of problems with it, because to get the air that hot and then to make metals not corrode too quickly with that plasma running over it, and sometimes it takes 20 minutes to wind them up to get them in the air, and that's why you never heard of them too often in the early days, shutting off, and because the kickstart was a real pain in the neck. But anyway, that was the original one that I was working on, was the breaststroker, which created a vacuum in front of the craft over the entire wing. So the entire wing surface sucked you forward. You didn't actually make a wake when you pushed through the air, and you could go hypersonic without making sonic booms. Anyway, that was propulsion two. Propulsion three was in development and maybe already being used by the time they recruited me. And that was one using toroidal, like a donut-shaped coils, wrapped in a particular way so that the coils, part of them were at right angles to other parts of the coil, in a kind of round donut shape. And these craft were truly electrogravitic, the first series of anti-gravity or gravity-bending craft. And they accomplished what a lot of people have been looking for by some clever rules of physics that were discovered back in the Philadelphia experiment. And that did take place. It wasn't quite as spectacular as the movie makes it, but the experiment did take place, as far as I understand.
But my God, Stan, you have described three systems of propulsion of unconventional craft that were in use 28 years ago. 28 years ago. Now,
well, they were actually in use before that time, yeah.
Before that time. And yep. One can only... Oh, God, where to start? Stan, where did this technology come from? Let me go there. Is this technology that we developed on our own, or is this technology we had outside assistance with? And when I say outside, I don't mean just outside the agency.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I really don't know. To give you a part of the story... another individual that worked in the European branch of this worldwide group that I was working for was assigned in security after World War II in Germany to guard a bunker there where they were doing research and development with these craft. They did have some German scientists there, but the main part of the information they were getting would come in every few weeks. Young men, slender build with thin briefcases, would come in and leave them blueprints and instructions to develop industry or industrial complexes to make stuff, not to see if it would work, just develop the industry so we can build this. We know it works already. So somewhere they were getting blueprints from a fait accompli somewhere else, and I have no idea, neither did the security guy, but they did work.
Well, you know what Colonel Corso had to say. The implications of what the colonel had to say were clearly that it was extraterrestrial technology obtained from a crash at Roswell that was then filtered into American industry.
That's quite possible.
Very carefully weaved into American industry, and you would seem to be suggesting that virtually the same thing was going on. In other words, people came in with plans to build craft, not to begin experimentation and to develop a technology, but to simply build from a technology which we had no base for, at least no base that we understood. So would your conjecture be that this technology came from elsewhere?
We certainly had help. And what I don't, I haven't been able to kind of answer to myself in a manner that I liked, is in 1958, you can see it in electronics journals in the library, in high voltage physics, they were talking openly up until, I think it was May of 1958, in the United States, Japan, and Europe, and England, about electrogravitics or anti-gravity.
I am aware of that, yes.
Okay, but in that month, after that month, in 1958, there were no more discussions, and there were over 100 institutions, universities, corporations, working and openly discussing this. There was never another paper published in the journals that said, forget it, it was a dead end, or whatever, just nothing. Now, what kind of an organization, I ask myself, could have the power to stop all these countries and universities outside the United States at the same time, the same month? So then I thought, right, okay, maybe, you know, aliens, maybe super beings, okay. Then why was I told in 1973, I think it was, in a meeting with my control agents down here in the organization, that someone was moving in on them and they were afraid they were winning? They never explained who they was. A bigger group was taking over the group that I was working for that was in charge of this technology.
Just makes no sense.
Well, believe me, I have puzzled over this for years and years. But it's a power play. Somewhere up there, there are some big folks having a big, big power play for control of the planet. I think it goes even further than that. But
well, for years and years and years, Americans, millions and millions of Americans, I'm one of them, have been seeing these totally unconventional craft and ascribing their presence to extraterrestrials, for the most part, because these craft are doing things that we don't even imagine our technology is anywhere close to. But according to what you're telling me, not only are we close to it, but we had it damn near when I was born.
Yes. Yes, look, I realize this sounds bizarre, and, you know, a lot of bizarre things get said on the show and everything there, and some are, you know, for entertainment value by folks, and I'm telling you, this is true. This is what really happened to me in life. I have seen the technology. I've been shown the photos of the under the ice cap base. I didn't go there. I know how it works. This is the incredible thing. I'm walking around, and I'm looking at antiques on the street, antiques in the air, and people are amazed when they see nothing can go that fast. And I whenever I get somebody that's willing to sit and listen, I'll say, look, sit down here. Let me draw on the sand or on a pad of paper here. Let me show you how it works and how you could do a similar thing in your garden with a water hose, and then you'll understand the concept. It's not, you know, it's just engineering that's made it flash, but the concept is very simple. And once I show them, then they say, oh, well, yeah, I know about that. I didn't realize that. I said, well, we've not got a thing on the planet that uses that in modern industry. It is only the newer technologies that have been withheld for a number of, well, in the beginning, some very good reasons, but now I'm not too sure.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. In other words, I can understand, I guess, during the Second World War, that there was a great need for secrecy. One might even imagine that in the Cold War years that followed, there was an equally large need for secrecy if we had these kind of things. But now, the world has changed. And Stan, we've been to war. If we had craft capable of this sort of thing, anti-gravitic technology, that sort of thing, that would allow weapons that would mean that we wouldn't have to send 500,000 men plus to the Persian Gulf to do a job that could be done by the kind of technology you're talking about. Why have we not used it?
Oh, very simple reason. It's been the same reason since Bob Gray started the group in 1949. Former Secretary of the Army, Robert Gray. The reason is this. Through years and centuries of fighting between one group and another on the planet, people have learned at the top that if you force a people into subjugation, whether it be a country or a world, If you force them into subjugation, you can't keep them there because eventually they will have guerrilla attacks and, you know, revolutionary tactics, and it'll destroy the fabric of what you're trying to establish as a global order, whether it's good or bad or whatever. You can't do that. You have to have the permission, you know, the like Hitler did with Germany before World War II. They asked him, in essence, to take over because things were so bad. Look, help us. He didn't come out and say, I've got the power in the government, I've got the military, and I can take over this country. No way. He let them ask him. Now, because they had a need. A lot of the needs they had at the time, you know, unemployment and, social problems with the children, not want to go to university, and there was dropouts, all that kind of junk. We have that now in a greater extreme. And we are crying out for someone to solve the problem. So the reason the United States and the group that was actually controlling this technology, it wasn't just the United States, it was trans-government. English heavily involved, Canadians, to a degree the Australians, we had some Germans, a lot of Germans involved. These people wanted to have a global government by consensus. But they couldn't do it as Germans or Russians or Americans, or not Russians, but Germans or Canadians or Americans or English. They had to do it as some group that had no political track record, no history.
What you're saying is that they wanted us to ask for a global government.
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly. Now, you wouldn't ask somebody of a known faith that was in opposition to yours or a known culture that was in opposition to yours. You wouldn't trust them, no matter how good they said they were, no matter how they said their spots had changed.
That's right.
It was realized back in 49, perhaps even further back than that, that an alien, whether it be alien from underneath the earth or from off the earth or parallel worlds, had to be invented or found to be this new neutral source of government.
Unifying a single threat, one might say.
Unifying a single what?
Unifying single threat. There were many times Ronald Reagan mentioned sort of wistfully that, gee, what if there was a single threat from outer space that we all had to face? You remember Reagan's statements on that subject?
I remember his wife, Nancy, bought a copy of my book about a year before that. I don't know whether she ever showed it to him or not.
Stan, hold on. We'll be right back.
All right.
And we will.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from April 10th, 1999. Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 10th of April, 1999.
Yep, me too. That's Crystal Gale. Good morning, everybody. Can you imagine that everything we thought we knew about our government is wrong? That everything we thought we knew about our technological advances that got us where we are today, the precarious position we're in today, all of that's wrong. And that the officials that we elect, the people we go out and vote for, are really the people that are orchestrating what goes on in the world, or at least in our very own country, or in the case of Stan, in his country, what is now his country. I guess Stan may have dual citizenship. I guess I should ask about that. But virtually all of our history is kind of a surface history, and that down below everything, really, it all happened in a very different way. Here's Stan Deo from Australia. Really disturbing stuff, Stan, because on the one hand, you know, I've grown up. I was born in 1945, right at the end of the war, the Second World War, Stan, and I've grown up at least on the surface kind of wanting to believe that most of what I know and believe to be true about my government, my country, is at least close to the truth. But if what all you say is true, then none of what I believe is true, or very little of what I believe is true. My elected officials are not really running the show. My vote is not really meaningful in the sense that no matter who I put in there, somebody else is yanking the strings. That is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is. Listen, just while we were on that break, we're having this confirmed, but a friend of ours in New York emailed Holly, young Morgan, and he said that Edgar Cayce made an interesting statement about the year 1958. He said that in that year they would discover the force that makes iron swim in water and stones float in air. Would that be electrogravity? I don't remember reading that. Of course, I haven't read Cayce's stuff in a long time, but I'm having him look it up at the moment and tell us. But wouldn't that be weird if that's what Cayce said?
And stones float in the air? Is that what he said?
Yep, yep.
Gee, that might even apply to Egypt. So maybe it wasn't so much a discovery as it was a rediscovery.
Exactly. In fact, I did a documentary TV show with a group here back in 83, and we went to the NASA at Houston and interviewed Dr. Henry Pold, who was one of the propulsion engineers, senior ones there for the space program, and a good friend and co-worker with Wernher von Braun. And we have him on film saying that he would not be surprised in the near future, at that time in 83, if they did not find an electrical solution to gravity, not unlike the one that he is convinced that they built the pyramids with. Now, this is, you know, like the gods of propulsion talking to us on camera at NASA.
Right.
And, I already knew. I went in there with your arm for bear because I knew what we had and wanted to see how much he knew. And he had a sly grin on his face, but that's all he let out in that interview. In fact, there was another fellow that knew something back in 77. Remember Steven Spielberg, the director?
As a matter of fact, I guess we ought to tell the audience, you are working on an interview for me with Steven Spielberg, aren't you?
Yes, but that's not what I was going to talk about.
I understand, but since you said it, I couldn't resist. And yes, of course, right. I would like to interview Steven Spielberg, of course.
Well, it's just that I know that he knows some things that would be quite interesting if he would share them with your audience about the UFO situation.
Mm-hmm.
Before he was a well-known director, he was just, you know, like the guy next door, very keen on the UFO thing, the alien thing. And he appeared on the same show, a documentary that I was on back in 1977 down here in Perth. And in that footage, he talked about sitting next to Reagan and having Reagan telling him something about who knew what about the UFO situation, the real truth about it. And, I'm trying to get him to just come out and talk like he did then because it was so casual and relaxed, not like it would be for him today because he'd be under the gun because everybody knows Stephen's name and be looking for him and everything. But anyway, I surely would like to have him say some of what he knows or has experienced in that field, because then you'd start to see that there are a lot of people all the way up to the White House that do have a sniff of what's going on.
Well, so, can you give us the substance of what he told you then?
That what everyone thought about the UFO situation wasn't really the truth, that it was a cover-up or like a plan that was different to what the popular tabloids and everything would have about aliens and all that kind of stuff. What I do think happened is that we did lose control of our own technology that we were developing from the help we had in the, whether it be Roswell, whether it be the Philadelphia experiment, whatever, that our own project, which was to invent a fake alien culture to bring the world together peacefully, that our own project was taken over by true non-humans who probably were the ones that were the gods in Sumeria, you know, to the peoples back then, you know, the superhumans or the super beings that had magic bigger than theirs, so they called them gods. And I think that they, perhaps some of the same ones, because of the way that the technology works, are alive today and here and have taken over what was to be an effort by scientists, engineers, industrialists to make a world government that would work. to overcome religious and cultural differences and racial differences, but it just we weren't able to keep control of it. I think that's probably why I was left alive down here instead of being fixed underground, is that my group down here realized they were in trouble. And so they released a lot of us out and told us to, in essence, run, gave us a little bit of incentive and said, if you don't, you're dead. And
they actually told you that straight out?
Well, here's how it went. All of my correspondence, the open correspondence and files, arrived on my doorstep at my house in Melbourne one morning with a courier, a chauffeur from Sir John's office.
Mm-hmm.
And he dropped all of my stuff in a box on the front porch while I was there, and with a note attached that said, my friends and I have no further use of your assistance now. Thank you. Goodbye. God bless. And then there was all kinds of memos and correspondence and everything that we had on the project and the drawings, all kinds of stuff.
Hmm.
So, you know, I was pretty, you know, destroyed by all that. But within a few weeks, a group of businessmen approached me to get funding for my research from Dutch Shell Oil, and which should make alarm bells go off with anybody that's familiar with conspiracy. But anyway, I was taken to lunch by the president of one of these companies, and just he and I had a really nice bottle of red wine and was feeling pretty rosy. And
mm-hmm.
he said, look, we've already decided we don't need to have a presentation from you. We're going to underwrite your continued research in these projects. And you said you needed to, for your power converter, you wanted to have an antenna that went up 1,400, 1,500 feet. What about if we give you a shaft that's 5,000 feet deep, put your instrumentation package down at the bottom, build your lab down there, and you could then have the antenna up like that without having to float it or anybody see it, and you could do the energy conversion that way. I said, well, gee, that'd be fine. He says, okay, well, from this point forward, tell no one, not your family, not your friends, no one, where you're going and what we're going to do. This must be secret. So I started thinking about it. I'm going to be at the bottom of a 5,000-foot mine shaft near Ballarat in the gold fields, working on a project that no one knows I'm there, and all those tons of rock up over the top of me.
My God, Stan, you've never told me all this before.
Well, we're getting into my mind, I guess, now, and I guess I know you better, but I don't know why they still let me run around except for this, because there was an awful lot locked up in there. Still is, I guess.
I can't imagine why they're leaving you alive to say this.
Well, the they that we're talking about are no longer in power. I think the guys that I was dealing with were, for the most part, gentlemen and real philosophers trying to solve the planet the best way they knew how. For a long time, I didn't understand that. But the older I've gotten, I was born the same year you were, in February, but the older I've gotten, I've realized that I was just illiterate, uneducated in the ways of moving large masses of people. And
Stan, I frankly don't even understand why they leave me alive to do what I do, much less why they've left you alive. It just doesn't make any sense unless we live in the free country with the Bill of Rights and the Constitution as we really think that it is, or we serve a purpose.
I think you serve a purpose, you and I both, plus the United States. But that purpose is coming to an end very soon, in my opinion.
Along with us, Stan?
Yeah. Along with a lot of us.
Well, there are a lot of changes going on in the world. Let me point you for a second in a separate direction. We were talking earlier today. I was talking with somebody at my network about I'm going to be on Larry King this the end of this week on Friday. Larry King.
I heard that.
I don't know if you get it in Australia. I don't think you do yet. And we were talking about some of the things that we might discuss. And for years and years and years on this program, we have been doing things that are a good half year to a year ahead of when the regular press catches on to them. And you represent one of those things. I don't know, it was several years ago when you and I first connected, Stan, and you began talking to me about the Navy's satellite photography of the oceans and how you had been plotting ocean temperatures and looking at ocean temperatures. And I think it was, 8 months to a year before we began to see this incredible, what they now call El Nino building. You began to talk to me about these ocean temperatures affecting our weather patterns and affecting volcanoes, affecting Earth movement, all the rest of it, just by looking at hot spots in the ocean. And you were making predictions that certainly came to fruition with what they call El Nino, and now La Nina, the opposite of it. And I guess I'd like to ask you for sort of an update on that, where we are right now. They're giving names to these changes, these radical changes that we're seeing. But I think that there's more to it than El Nino and La Nina. I think that we're undergoing some sort of fairly profound basic change. What do you think's going on?
Well, I think a lot of the climate or weather changes, climate and weather changes, are coming from things happening on the sun and inside the sun. What I have just in the last, well, week or so discovered, or think I've discovered, is something rather bizarre with the spin rate of the sun. Most of us think that the sun is up there kind of gaseous ball, but that it kind of spins around like a solid ball would. But it doesn't. You remember the equator of the sun spins faster than the poles do. It spins around once in 25 days at the equator on the sun, and the poles spin around once in 36 days. And in between there, the spin varies and curls and twists and all kinds of stuff. And so there's still great discussions going on about how to determine the spin rate of the solid core sun down under what we can detect at the moment with our instruments.
Are these things, Stan, that SOHO, the satellite SOHO, would be able to determine or is now studying?
I'm fairly close to that project, having communicated with the people who actually download the computers off the SOHO. And they're just kind of average type good Joes. I mean, no scientists and things like that. There's no hocus pocus when we talk. And it is beyond its expected life as a satellite. It was not designed to do much more than what it's done. And the metal lenses for the digital cameras and stuff like that are getting pitted by, you know, protons and other particles blown at it with the sun consistently over the years it's been up. What does interest us at the moment is, well, I say us, me, not me and those guys, but those of us watching this thing, is the alleged object that has been seen in a couple of SOHO photographs since it came back online with the new kind of programming to...
My God, I was about to ask you, listen, I've been getting some communication from Whitley Strieber about an object orbiting the sun that he's researching very, very, very hard right now. I probably shouldn't even be mentioning it. But I know the SOHO has taken a couple of photographs of what seem to be anomalous objects, and then right after those photographs have somehow leaked out or come out, SOHO has somewhat mysteriously shut down for a period of time. You're aware of that?
Yeah, it goes into what's called a save mode.
Yes.
The period of that thing that Strieber and a few other people are looking at would be around 24 to 25-day period, maybe even up to 32-day period. I think they've got some estimates. What really kind of rings alarm bells in my mind is it's something to do with the sun itself, because it has the same kind of a rotational period between 25 and 36 days. Mm. There, the sun, we look at, you know, I study sunspots going back 250 years and you know, in more recent times, day by day. And I found something last week that showed that the peak sunspot activity we get has, in the last 6 months, been around a period of 26 days. In other words, the high sunspot peak would be today, and then 26 days later it would be again, whether it be high or low, it'd be
right.
26 days.
Right.
Okay. Before that, going back to the 60s, the average peak was around 27 to 27 and a half days. In other words, something is shortening the sunspot period, and I don't know whether it's actually the core spinning faster or what. If it's the core spinning faster, then it's probably because something inside the sun is shrinking. And we do know that the sun has been shrinking. That's been measured.
Yeah, but not that fast.
Not that fast. That is absolutely correct. We're talking about 3 to 5% shrinkage there in a very short time. And if that is happening, it may be about to throw off a bunch of stuff on the outer surface. And this is a wild guess, okay? It's no dreams or prophecies or anything. And scientifically, I'm on very shaky grounds here, but something is wrong there. And the sunspot activity is ahead of schedule for what cycle 23 should be. They thought it would peak anytime between June and April or something next year. But there are about three or four different camps of scientists trying to determine when this sunspot cycle is going to peak out at maximum.
I know there's a lot of controversy about that right now, and I've been watching this particular cycle very, very carefully myself, just for selfish ham radio type reasons, because that affects, of course, shortwave transmission heavily. And it really is a bizarre cycle so far. Really hard to read.
It is, and it's consequently, in the Otis thermal map that you're talking about, it is hard for us to be positive where we're going in the next few months. But I can tell you this: I've put it up on the website, a series of photos or images from 1996 through to today, about five images showing what the anomalous heating and cooling of the entire planet looked like on the oceans, year by year. And you see that we are in something that is a cross between a Niño and a Niña right now, and we're heading for what may be a super, like the mother of El Niños in the next 9 to 10 months. We're already past the point where I called the alert with you that first time on your show back, 96, 97, something like that?
Yes.
96, I guess it was.
Yes, I believe 96. Mm-hmm.
We've already exceeded that kind of anomalous heating on the planet in the Pacific, and some really weird things are happening when the sun burps, when it puts out bursts of energy and extreme coronal mass ejections, which it does very frequently these days. Within 4 days, we get supermagnetic storms because it hits our upper atmosphere and the ionosphere, right, and it generates currents. Well, I noticed immediately when we had the big one here recently that areas that were bigger than, it couldn't be bigger than Texas, but it was maybe about a third the size of Texas, right? In the ocean, areas like that near Kamchatka, the Russian peninsula out there, would suddenly heat up and in the space of less than 12 hours cool down the other way, make a 10-degree shift in temperature, and then it would bounce over to the other side of, say, South America. And these anomalous heating things were electrical phenomena carrying heat out of the core of the planet, I'm sure, up into the surface of the ocean and then back again. And it just ricocheted like a ball inside the Earth after we had that huge display or that storm from the sun. And I think we're headed for more of these. We haven't even reached maximum yet, and we've already hit 210 sunspots. We're already at 145 or so on the smooth sunspot average curve.
That's right. I saw the 210. That really surprised me, really surprised me. That happened very quickly.
There are 2 days a year that you've got to watch, the 5th of March and the 6th of September every year.
All right. We'll find out when we come back exactly why that is. 2 days to watch, huh? All right. Stan Deo is my guest from Australia. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
You won't read that book again because the ending just too hard to take.
Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
For all of you, by the way, who corrected me on a couple of scores, one is the word can see. It's can't see.
I walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way spin.
Enter number two.
Enter number two.
It's a wonderful song, isn't it?
Movie.
Gordon Lightfoot, Canadian, by the way. And one other thing that I had 10,000 corrections on, it is not Mackinac Island, even though it appears to be and should be pronounced Mackinac. It's Mackinac Island, and so thank all of you who corrected me on that. I'm going to the Somewhere in Time weekend on Mackinac Island. If you happen to see that movie, it's one of my all-time favorites. That's my movie comment. and October 29th, I think, through the 31st. This is a personal thing I'm doing. It's not a group thing at all. I'm just doing this on my own, and so I'm going to be there. There's something about that movie that haunts me, the way Gordon there was haunted, Somewhere in Time. If you saw it, you know what the Grand Hotel is. It's on Mackinac Island, and I'm going to be going there for the reunion, I would assume, with a lot of like-minded people. And I'm really looking forward to that. But I did screw it up. It's not Mackinac. It's Mackinac Island. All right, in a moment, we'll get back with Stan Deo, Way Down Under, and your calls. Here we go again. Stan, welcome back. Thanks for hanging in with us.
Oh, no problem. It's a lot earlier here than it is for you.
Well, I'm used to these hours. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stan Deo, Down Under. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Stan.
Hi.
Greetings from Virginia Beach, Virginia. My name's Joshua. I'm a graduate student here. I got a question for Stan. My question is, it kind of seems that there's a desensitizing of our culture of the potential of extraterrestrials being our saviors, somewhat of ourselves or from our governments or from our technology. Is it possible that the welcoming, kind of using an Art Bell phrase, like the quickening, the welcoming of a global government is being orchestrated by, say, fallen angels?
Well, yeah, if you've read, I guess, the first or maybe second book, too, that I wrote, I did address this as the great deception I think is coming. And I didn't arrive at that purely by Bible study. It was from working inside this group and knowing that they were going to fake an alien landing at one time. The subsequent information I've been able to get out of the Middle East, some of the older documents, tells a slightly different story in that these beings are not necessarily what we made, but they were back there when we were created, when the real God and Creator created us. I think the way I see that it will play is that America has been host to the alien or the fallen angels, whatever you want to call them, these super beings from the past. They have been host to them in the underground bases and have allowed them to house their facilities in the United States and territories of the United States while they were giving the Americans and the British, whatever, shared technology for this. However, I think in the end what will happen is that there will be a mass exodus of the alien presence in America. We'll see them leave suddenly. And one way or another, America will be very rapidly destroyed as a world power within days, I think. And the exodus of these alien critters and their craft and technology will go over to either Iraq or Iran and set up base there, as the old writings do indicate, near Basra somewhere. And I think this will be these beings returning to the area where they were most familiar before the great conflagration, you know, the great floods and the earthquakes and stuff that broke up Atlantis. But I think that's what the Genesis 6 tale was talking about, is that advanced civilization that was hybrid beings from, you know, the fallen angels, we wish, that the sons of God, like Plato said, coming down and mating with human women. And that was all destroyed back there, but that was their old dig. So I think they're going back there to set up the world government from there, but without the United States, because I think the United States will be just fairly well destroyed.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Stan Deo. Hello.
Hello, Stan. Along the same lines, I have two questions. Do you have any timeline or window when this event will happen to the United States and when these beings, so to speak, move over to the Mideast? Any gut feeling, maybe?
Well, it would only be that.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a dream back in 96 in January, I think it was, which I put onto the website for some time. Every part of that dream has come to pass except the last part, which I've been trying to see, and that is a large meteor shower that would fall over the Pacific, you know, the west coast of the United States.
Right.
Pre-dawn, and I thought the Leonid shower this last time might have been it, but it didn't do it.
But do you remember?
We have another window
right
in November.
But do you remember, even before the Leonid shower, I think you mentioned it almost positive it was on your site, and I may be wrong. I live in California. I'm calling from San Jose. There was a pre-dawn, and I'll look at my archives, and if I find the article, I'll email it to you. There was a pre-dawn event like that. Do you remember, like, it was about maybe, maybe 2 years ago or a year ago?
There was something.
Remember?
I think it was toward dusk, actually. Or I think it was toward sundown, and before sundown, and a lot of motorists were seeing the things falling and burning across the sky.
Okay, so the time wasn't correct then. You're saying pre-dawn.
Everything else was correct. Absolutely, what I saw in the dream has come to pass. And this last part was like a curtain of burning embers with flames coming. It was just huge all across the western sky. It wasn't something that a few people had to be in the right place to see. To me, it just lit up everything.
All right.
And I don't know whether it'll be some other surprise or whether it'll be Leonid's or what, but when that comes, I know that I'm to turn around to the people I'm talking to through the web and say, it really begins now, mark time from now. This is the beginning.
All right.
Did you explain the reason why March 5th and September are fairly important dates?
Thank you, caller. Those were 2 days that I meant to come back to. Thank you very much. Yes. Please, Stan.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Those 2 days are the two periods of time when we're exposed to portions of the solar wind at maximum, because the sun spins slightly off tilt on its axis. It's 7.2 degrees tilted to the side, and we're tilted 23.5 degrees to ours. And twice a year on those dates, it's at the maximum solar wind disturbance that we're going to get occurs peaks at those times. And we're coming up to that time now at the same time that we're having other activity on the sun toward a solar maximum for solar cycle 23. So now, or in September, early September, I feel could be some very interesting phenomenon on the surface of the Earth.
All right, so
it's funny, New Scientist put an article out the last couple of days on the sun, what would happen if it were to blow some big globs of fire off toward the Earth and how it would affect the power stations and radio and everything. I don't have the article at hand, but they've even made a public statement about it there.
Yes, it's called Ejecta. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is John in Atlanta.
Yes, sir.
Did I hear you at the beginning of the program where you mentioned that maybe Stan would talk about the JFK assassination, or am I dreaming?
No, Stan mentioned the assassination. I don't know how much more he wants to say. Stan?
John, what was your question about him?
Well, I just wondered what you might know besides what's, we've all read with the conspiracies and all. I've done a lot of research in it. I'm very interested in it. When I heard you mention that, I thought Art did, but I figured you might know something.
Let me say this. In the Warren Commission documents, which everybody kind of thought was a whitewash, there were a couple of clues that gave away some very pertinent information. One was that several of the witnesses on the grassy knoll heard a shot that sounded like a cannon. Two was that one security man was arrested or stopped coming up out of a manhole behind the grassy knoll, behind the fence where the guy with the rifle was supposed to have been. And this man was dressed in a suit wearing White House security colors of the day, on his badge when they stopped him, a policeman stopped him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wearing ear cups. He'd just come from the rain drain tunnel, which ran under that street that the Kennedy's car was shot on. That was in the Warren Commission report. To make a cannon sound, you have to have a big tube. And the gun, there was a pistol, a 45 caliber pistol, came into possession of a friend of mine, an acquaintance, who worked for the mafia. And he turned himself into District Attorney Jim Garrison at that time, a little bit after that when Garrison was pushing, with the pistol and the story that it was used down in the rain drain, which I've gone and stood in and photographed from, so that the man was within about 10 feet of Kennedy when he shot him from the front as the car passed over the top of the car. And that's why it lifted him up and took part of his skull out at the top. It was a low-angle, high-mass, low-velocity bullet. It was a 45 caliber pistol that finished him. Now, these people worked in connection with the mafia. There was a lot more on Jack Ruby and why he got prime treatment, but that's another story.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Hi, this is Lynn from Sandy. And I would like to ask about how Stan thinks the Hawaiian Islands would fare.
Is that Sandy, Utah?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. All right.
And I would like to ask him how he thinks shipping or food or whatever. It seems nice and warm. I wouldn't freeze. But how would the food supply work on the two larger islands?
In other words, with the changes that may be coming, Stan, would you move to Australia? You did move to Australia, to Hawaii.
Well, I don't want to be a scaremonger, but I certainly wouldn't choose that myself, no. Reason being that it is an island built on volcanic stuff that's still very active. Certainly a lot more active than these things I've got here that have got tons of dirt and sediment piled on top of them. If it were at all possible, I would choose some other place where I've got a lot more dirt around me and maybe some high ground that's very old and fairly stable. I guess, you know, I can only say I chose to stay here where we are because of that reason. I don't have good news for you.
Even though it's the side of a volcano.
Yeah, even though it's the side of a volcano. there's 400 of them dotted around us here that are covered up with fields and paddocks and trees. They're not extinct, but none of them have ever gone off in recorded history here. The last one was 7,500 years ago, so they could come active. But we have more room to navigate and move here than a person would on any island, whether it be Hawaii or Fiji or Vanuatu or whatever.
Do you remember an old movie, Stan, called On the Beach?
Oh, Neville Shute, yes.
Yeah. I think it was Australia that was the last to go, wasn't it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's a nuclear war, and the spread of the toxins, the radioactive toxins that killed the Northern Hemisphere, the combatants, took its time getting down to Australia, and the people here kind of took on a MASH attitude, you know, the series MASH, where they had fun and did the things they always wanted to do on their way to dying. They thought, well, if we're going to go, we might as well ignore the fact and have fun. So they did, and I think it was a very prophetic book in some respects.
The book was incredible. I'm trying to get a copy of it. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Hi, my name's Gwen. I'm quite happily situated on the Canadian Shield. I had a couple of questions, one question, I guess, and a couple of comments. For Steve, one of them was about referring back to people talking about the sudden spread of certain illnesses and such. And,
hold on just a second. Hold on.
I'm sorry.
Art, can you hear me?
Yeah.
She's breaking up. There's something interrupting her line. I can't hear what she's saying.
All right. Try it again, ma'am.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Just directly ask her a question.
Okay. I have an ill. I'm ill with a very strange version of a chronic illness, and it's supposedly one of the illnesses that sort of disappeared in the 80s, chronic fatigue syndrome. And my version of the illness has taken me to the point where I'm pretty much dependent on narcotic painkillers and I'm in a wheelchair. And I was just wondering, like, with the downplay of the illness and the weird spread of the illness, how it sort of seemed to pop up, if there was anything to do with biological warfare or anything like that, or if it was, like, related to the Gulf War syndrome.
All right, she has what's called chronic fatigue syndrome, which
right.
is not talked about much anymore. I don't know whether you heard that or not.
Yeah.
And she's she's wondering whether it's related to some sort of biological warfare program or possibly the Gulf War syndrome or something like that.
Oh, that's a hard question. I don't know the answer to that. Where was she calling from?
I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
I was having trouble because about every other word was totally bleeped out. It wasn't. I mean, it's like a loose connection somewhere.
Weird.
Yeah.
Well, you know that's a question for a physician, I think, not Stan Dale. Anyway, so we'll leave it at that.
I know everything.
Yeah, that's right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Stan Dale in Australia. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Art. This is Dan in Virginia.
Yes, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Stan. Stan, what's your views on what they're going to find in Egypt tonight?
Are you aware of the opening live show that's going to open some previously unopened areas in Egypt, Stan?
Yes.
I'm aware of that. We are going to see it here. They've been billing it here. It will be live. Was it Wednesday night, isn't it? The Wednesday night when it comes on?
Well, it's going to be tonight here, which will be Tuesday night in the States. So I would assume if you're going to see it live, you're going to see it...
during the day Wednesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll probably see it Wednesday afternoon early. Okay, I know that they've been billing it. My take on it is a rather, is certainly one of a lot of interest, because about 3 or 4 years ago, I got this mysterious phone call from a guy in England with a Scottish accent. He was in London, and he called, introduced himself, and gave his particulars. And at that time, he was representing the Prime Minister and the Duke of Edinburgh in a dig in Egypt at the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
That they had been opening, and they had gotten into the front chamber of it, had trouble with water flooding and things like that, and they saw something on the door to the tomb room they were going in, which led them to believe that it was the tomb of Alexander that, the Pharaoh Ptolemy or Pompey or something, I forget who it was anyway, built for him. And I asked why he was calling me about this, and he said it was to invite me to the dig when they open it, because there was something on the door that they had seen carved there that reminded them of the front cover of my book, the Cosmic Conspiracy thing, with that pyramid and the glass eye and all that kind of stuff up on top of it. Well, I sat around waiting for the next phone call and never received it. They kept getting water apparently pumped out and finally gave up for a while. I think it was a woman in charge of the dig anyway. So, you know, my interest was piqued at that time, and then I started looking at the front cover of my book. And there I have a capstone, the missing capstone, sitting back down, or trying to sit on the pyramid there, as the sign of the Antichrist coming back to take his throne in that area.
Well, you're aware they're going to replace the capstone on the Great Pyramid December 31st, 1999, at midnight.
I heard that.
That's not a rumor. That's a fact.
I know. I'm glad I'm living in Australia when it happens. I think Herodotus spoke of the Great Pyramid in some of his writings at that time of having a moat all the way around it. And
Stan, before we leave this half hour, what is your email address in case people want to send you mail?
I'm at Stan Deyo, Stan Deyo,
right?
At sign NetConnect, that's NetConnect. com.au. Actually, Art, it might be an interesting exercise if they're emailing that address, that everyone who hears this on the Internet, only the Internet people, who's listening to it like on real audio, if they would email us to say where they're listening to it from, we might get some kind of an idea where the distribution of listeners are on the Internet.
All right, Standale at netconnect.com.au. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, stay right there. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
The rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark.
Sailing away on the crest of a wave.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from April 10th, 1999.
Good morning, everybody. Stan Deyo is here from Australia, way down under. We've been talking about what our government has been doing and knows and has been testing for a very long time, maybe since just about when I was born. Y2K, contrails, gun laws, what's going on with our sun? If you have questions for Stan, that's where we're going next. We're going to open the lines and let you ask what you would like. Into the stretch run here, Stan. Looks like you're going to make it all the way. Here we go again. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stan down under.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Paulina. I'm calling from Seattle. I just had a question for Stan regarding the 6th of September. I just wondered if this happens with the sun on that date every year.
Yeah, that's every year. It wasn't meant to be saying, oh, September the 6th, do something, you know, and hide. It was simply that this happens to be the peak solar wind activity or influence we get on the Earth for geomagnetic storms twice a year.
It's just because that date is the anniversary of the funeral of Princess Diana. And I just wondered if you ever considered the effect of the sun having effect on the Earth. Because, you know, I don't think in the history of the planet have so many people grieved over the death of somebody because there hasn't been that many people on the planet before.
Well, I don't know that there is a connection. But one could imagine a connection between what goes on the sun and human behavior, because we are connected to this planet, which is connected to the sun. So I guess you could broadly suggest there would be a connection. What do you think, Stan?
Oh, well, it's hard to say. I mean, look, we're getting into areas of mysticism here where anything's possible. But, I think we wait until the events and then put them back together after the fact. Then we can make a good story.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Hi, Art and Stan. Stan, you briefly mentioned earlier about the movie The Philadelphia Experiment, and Art interviewed a man that said he was taken from the 1940s and put into the 1980s and then back again. Is that true?
Well, again, I'm not privy to everything that went on in that experiment. I did talk to Townsend Brown about it before he died, and to a member of the Atomic Energy Commission in London, Dr. Tatford. But as far as I understand from what I was shown and had explained to me, I did see the working diagrams of the minesweeper and how it was wired for the test, that the only alteration of time was local field, and so that anybody inside the field experienced the passage of time quicker than those on the outside of the field, so the 2 hours was just a few minutes for them. But as far as I can determine, no one was reported to have gone forward in time and back. Personally, I think that would be very, very difficult at all. But certainly going forward in time and staying would be possible.
Huh.
It's the returning.
So in other words, you think that some of what we imagine did occur, that there was some sort of experiment that really was done. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was toroidal field coils, three-axis field coils and pulsed coils, and the reason they used that chip was because they were short for budgets and in the war, and they had to take what was already built, and the minesweeper was already built with the iron hull and the three coil axes that they used to generate magnetic fields for minesweeping, and so they just souped that up with a 16 kilowatt generator, a DC generator, and that's how they made their field coil test.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Art, and hi, Stan. These alien beings you're talking about, these demon beings, do they look like normal people? Are there any identifying marks on them that, we can point them out in society or something? I'll listen off the air, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Well, I must tell you here, I have never, to my knowledge anyway, met an alien being. I have probably read more reports from places that people don't have access to about this subject. The most I can say is that from the old writings, the Sumerians and the Babylonians and stuff, some of the Egyptian writings, there is indication that they were taller as a general rule than the average person, were handsome features, fair-skinned, and these were the human, humanoid type beings. And when they mated with our women, the offspring were sterile, the seeds that have been fixed that don't reproduce. And that they had abilities, mental and physical, above the average peanut, but they died with them when they died because they couldn't reproduce. So today, what's running around is slightly different in that we have reports of hybrid hosts for these beings, for their consciousness to inhabit or drive or something like automatons, so these little gray things and the big gray things.
So those you probably wouldn't see walking down the street. If any are among us, I'm sure they would walk and talk and look fairly human, if not slightly taller and, you know, quite handsome for whatever sex they are.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Mr. Bell.
Yes, sir.
This is Robert, San Joaquin Valley, California, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, I got a couple of things for Mr. Dale, but I'd like to mention to you, if I may, a couple of weeks ago, thereabouts, you mentioned about when you get your that vaccine, the polio vaccine.
Yes.
And you received yours before 63?
I received mine, you know, I would have to think really hard about that, but I was one of the first volunteers.
Well, you and me both. I was one of the first 100 volunteers with Jonah Salk.
Uh-huh.
And I got those and the booster, and then when the Sabin one came along with the sugar cubes, I got those, and I got so much of that polio vaccine in me.
Yeah, I had the sugar cubes as well.
Yeah, people ask me if I ever had any side effects. I said, well, occasionally, sometimes I have an urge to climb trees and swing in branches. But that's about it.
Uh-huh. Well.
But I don't think we have anything to worry about, sir.
If you say so. All right. Do you have a question?
Yes. Mr. Dale, I sure appreciate you, sir, very much. And I hope whatever you do that you'll just be careful. And I just wanted to ask you if you know anything about this, because Richard Hoagland, he's always giving reference to 19.5. And I was just wondering, because they talk about warping and bringing space and time together to go in and out of dimensions. He's mentioned it so many times. I'm just wondering if there's anything about that that you may know of and you want to tell us about.
You mean about the, like, transdimensional travel or doorways, things like that?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, well, the Philadelphia experiment, strangely enough, was something that almost breached that parallel universe thing, because by varying some of the phase angles and pulse rates between the coils, you can cause the energy to stack inside the field when you turn it on. A Volkswagen engine over a period of an hour would put enough energy into one of these fields to make that battleship disappear. It doesn't take much power if you use it over a period of time and stack it. I did some experiments with a small coil myself years ago in Dallas and did manage to bend light for a fraction of a second in the room, possibly almost breaching a gateway between the parallel universes. I'm reasonably certain from the older records we can get, even in the Hebrew biblical records, that the levels of existence are like parallel shells of universes all coexisting around nodes, if you wish, and that we have universes right next to us that we could port through, like the TV series that used to be on called Sliders or something like that. In fact, their coil looked very much like what we were playing with.
So you actually bent light.
Yes, it was such a short duration. What it looked like was like the whole room around the lab had Saran wrap on it, and it was poked down into the center of the coil. And when it fired, when it pulsed, it was as though somebody tried to pull that Saran wrap down in the center of the coil, and it wrinkled all the light coming in from the walls and, you know, the tables and everything, as though it were bent down into that in this weird pulling, stretching movement. And I got quite nauseous because I felt like I rolled. My stomach rolled as though I were rolling into the coil center. But it was a very short-term event. I couldn't get it to fire again. I met another guy down in Australia years later, who had the same effect, same problem with his coil.
Boy, that's absolutely remarkable. Hold on just one sec. Let me reset something here, Stan, and let me see if I can bring the level up a little bit. Okay, say something.
Hello?
Hello there. Okay, yeah. That's good. Good.
I'm still having a dropout, even as talking to you.
I understand. We have that condition that occurs occasionally, and I guess, you know, we're staying hooked up here between America and Australia for, 4 hours? So, aside from a big phone bill, I think you begin to get effects after a while.
All right, well done.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Stan Dale. Hi.
Hi, this is Dan from Portland.
Hello, Dan.
I had a question for Stan. I heard him talk earlier about the dig there in Egypt, Alexander's tomb.
Yes.
And I was kind of curious about that. I heard that on the news. It was broadcast all over the news a few years ago, and I'd never heard anything since. I was wondering what the status is of that dig and whether or not it is, in fact, Alexander's tomb and if anything significant has been found there.
Dan, you would have heard what was happening when I got the phone call, I guess. After that time, I didn't get any more contact from the folks in London, and I don't know, other than a letter I got about the water in the dig. I don't know what they've done. I don't know if it's part of what they're going to open up over there now. I wish I did, because it certainly got my curiosity up, and you can bet I'll be watching the show.
Yeah, so you think this might be on the show then?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether it's a new dig or just old things are opening up. If they had to go through, if we see they had to go through a chamber that had been flooded beforehand, then it may be the same one. That, all I can tell you is the only reason that they delayed getting me over there at that time was because they couldn't stop the flooding of the chamber in front of the actual tomb area they wanted to get into. It would just they couldn't pump keep it pumped out fast enough apparently. And that's the only clue I've got as to what dig it was.
Yeah, I think there would be some tremendous information found if that truly was Alexander's tomb is all.
You're gonna be watching the special on Fox tonight?
Yes I am, now that I've been made aware of it.
Good enough. Well, we'll see what happens. Wildcard Line, thanks. You're on the air with Stan Deo in Australia. Hello.
Good evening. I wanted to present a scenario, and then, you know, I have a two-part question at the end. First of all, Art, when you had William Thomas on, I tried to get through and let him know that I wanted to mention a book that was written 10 years ago that corroborates what he's talking about as far as Army testing over populated areas, and the book is called Clouds of Secrecy, The Army's Germ Warfare Tests Over Populated Areas by Leonard Cole.
Well, we know they do it.
Yeah, and that goes back to 1950 in San Francisco.
Sure.
My scenario is, I feel it's basically the Fourth Reich. You know, it's the International Fascist Network. 1947 was a pretty pivotal year. You have Roswell, which I thought was staged. Well, I wasn't there, obviously. You have Nazis streaming in at this time to the U.S., Central and South America, Canada by the thousands. General Galen helps found the CIA with the help of the Dulles brothers out of the OSS.
Mm-hmm.
Werner von Braun refuses to work for us unless we rescue his boss, General Dornberger, who was scheduled for the gallows. In swoops the Air Force, and NASA's in business. Dornberger ended up heading Bell Helicopter, which made $50 billion in Vietnam alone. And finally, the pièce de résistance of the whole scenario, which I think controlled everything, was the National Security Act, as signed by Truman, creating the National Security State, which, in my opinion, is a very fascistic structure, incompatible with either a republic or a democracy. As the Grateful Dead said, what a long, strange trip it's been. My opinion is no doubt. It's been a 50-year psyop. Now, Mr. Dale, you made a reference earlier in the show to military mind control experiments performed on you during the military. And my two-part question is, are you familiar with two books, Shefflin and Optin's The Mind Manipulators or Walter Boert's Operation Mind Control? And if so, what they described in their books, does that dovetail with what happened to you? And part two, are you concerned about long-term programming or that most of what you were programmed with was disinformation?
All right. Stan?
I'm not sure. I think I remember the Operation Mind Control book. I don't know the authors. I couldn't tell you to save myself at the moment, but it's been so long since I read it that I couldn't tell you whether it was the same kind of stuff that I went through or not.
Are you concerned that any of what was done then is still affecting you now?
Oh, well, not concerned. I considered every now and then. Certainly I know that some of my martial arts stuff that was there comes out when I'm asleep or someone wakes me up very quietly. I have to be careful not to hurt people around me sometimes when they wake me up like that, but that's the only thing I've seen of late that surfaced that was, you know, ex-military. I haven't been worried enough about that. I thought, well, look, I'll go get a hypnotist or something and dig it out. I just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether they can condition you even then with something that would last a lifetime without reinforcement along the way. And I think I've been fairly well away from any sort of potential reinforcement the lifestyle I've led. So I'm not too concerned about it.
All right.
There was one thing he mentioned about the fascist state and all that. I do have a real worry for folks who are Jewish or Judeo-Christian, who are Jewish sympathizers in the United States or in Australia for that matter, but particularly in the States, because I do feel that there is a rising anti-Semitism in the world, and particularly in the south of the United States, and this does bother me. It is we can see the genocide forming again, and it's not just Jews this time, but people who think alike in that respect. And I am concerned and do expect full well that a number of Jewish folk from the United States and Great Britain will eventually migrate back to Israel for safety. So this fascist type thing you're talking about may well be part of what's happening. So I'm giving a little credence to what you're saying.
All right. I want to give everybody Stan's email address again, and you might just email him and let him know where you are listening from. And that would be Stan Deyo, S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O, Deyo, at netconnect.com, dot A-U. That would be Australia. That's Stan Deyo at netconnect.com, dot A-U for Australia. Right, Stan?
That's correct.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Stan Deyo. Hi.
Yeah, good evening, Art, Stan. Stan, do you think there's any possibility, whatever, you know, the experiments of mind control, whatever, but do you think there's a possibility, and of course that's a broad word, but that the public's being jerked around a little bit on this UFO gig, and I mean this idea that Teller would share with you, well, 50 UFOs in Antarctica and the rest of this.
Are you asking whether Stan was jerked around about it or whether we're being?
Well, both.
Okay. Stan, do you think it's possible that you were fed disinformation?
Oh, well, anything's possible. I don't think it's probable, mainly because I understand how the field works and have used it to build a small a boat that I have demonstrated here in Australia in the water. It does work. So that's not disinformation. This is a technology. It's called asymmetric propulsion. And so for that reason, I tend to believe the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Indoctrination would have only been technology. We never got into philosophical issues until the day I was leaving.
Okay. All right. I think we can squeeze one last in. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stan Deyo. Where are you, please?
I'm in Cameron, Texas.
Cameron, Texas. All right.
Yes, I'm just listening to the show, and I'm seeing a lot of things that seem to relate to each other. We get into extraterrestrial. We get into the government controlling the public. I see this every day. When I was 16, I had several experiences that were of a extraterrestrial nature, which involved several deja vu episodes, things that...
Why would you say that something that gives you deja vu, which is simply a recollection of something that has occurred to you before, would be extraterrestrial in origin?
Well, because it was fed to me extraterrestrially, okay? These things came to me in my dreams. They were prophesied to me in my dreams.
Uh-huh.
And then they actually occurred.
Well, I think that, Stan, you've had a number of dreams, haven't you, that you have considered to be prophecy that have come true or mostly true?
Oh, yeah. The ones that are still hanging out are the most recent ones to do with only with Lake Taupo over in New Zealand. But you certainly know the difference between a normal dream and one of these things when it grabs you. You don't forget it.
All right, Stan, we are woefully out of time, and we have done it again. You've done a clean cut 4 hours from down under.
Art, I miss your place. Miss the folks. Holly and I both do. We just thought we'd tell you that.
Thank you, my friend. And take care down there, and hopefully we will be doing yet another show before whatever comes down, comes down.
Okay, my friend. Take care.
Take care. That's Stan Deyo from Australia, and you might fire him off some email. That's Stan Deyo, S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O, at netconnect.com.au. And that's it for now. From the high desert, that's all there is. And we've got a little guest shuffle going on, so we'll see what happens tomorrow night. something, I'm sure. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.